What's up, Bulls fans? Welcome to another episode of It's Brewing at McEwen. I'm your host this evening, Adam Cartwright, and with me, as always, on the Monday Night Breakdown, Matt Giardino. Matt, how you doing, man?
Doing good. Actually, I'm doing great, especially after that weekend sweep of Tulane. It's a long time coming that we end up beating Tulane in that fashion. So really, really excited about the performance this past week.
Yeah, absolutely. As Matt alluded to, we're going to look at that Tulane series, the Friday, Saturday, Sunday sweep. We're also going to take a look at the ACC, AAC, ooh, that's that one up, AAC standings. Then we'll look at the 11.7 rankings. We're also going to talk about USF's future outlook, kind of all things considered when we get there. We got a little national discussion point that me and Matt are going to have. Hopefully, you guys will leave us some comments on the social media posts, as I'd kind of like to hear you guys' opinion on that. But we'll get to there, and then we're going to close it up with a little look at the midweek matchup with Bethune-Cookman. Well, without further ado, Matt, let's get right into it. Friday night started off with a huge bang. It was a 3-1 victory for the Bulls, but the story of the night was Corey Braun, who went 9 innings, only gave up 2 hits and no runs. Yeah, it was huge. I'm going to leave it at that, and I'm just going to let you get right into it, Matt. What did you think about Friday night?
Yeah, I mean, if there's ever any question, which there shouldn't have been, if Corey Braun is a dog, that was answered on Friday night. Not only did he go 9 innings, but he also pitched 121 total pitches as well. Only walked one batter, which is really great to see. I think in outings where he hasn't been able to get into the seventh inning, it's because he's walking three, four, at times maybe five guys. So he was on. He was as on as he has been all season, and just the overall efficiency to be able to pitch those 9 innings, really good to see.
Absolutely. He was on, and he was on from the start. And really, his performance kind of overshadows in the way that Tulane's starter Luke Flauta was on too. He had a pretty decent night. And the guy they brought in after that had a good night. It was what you would expect on a Friday night when you send your ace out there. You're going to get the other team's best, and that's what we got. And he just dominated. He was that much better. I think when you look on the offensive side, there really isn't much to talk about. There was no extra base hits either side. We got our runs on singles, clutch singles when we needed them. Obviously, when you're facing somebody tough, you got to make it happen like that. But yeah, just what a performance by Corey Brown. I remember the broadcast talking about the last time they had seen these things that happened. They mentioned a Hunter Minck complete game. And that was against Charlotte in Charlotte in an 11-2 victory. And they mentioned Colin Sullivan in a 7-inning shutout victory. But they did not know the last time it had happened at home and made no comments about the last time it was a 9-inning shutout. And so I think what we can take away from this is it was special for this university. It's been a long, long time since we've seen a performance like that. And just hats off, kudos to him. Any final thoughts on Friday?
Yeah, the other thing that I was thinking too is how cool it was that everybody in the in attendance really knew the significance of that final top of the ninth inning, and they the whole crowd got on their feet, were cheering on Corey the whole way in the ninth inning. I thought that was really cool, especially on a pretty significant night for USF baseball with the alumni gathering that they had. So we had a really strong crowd of over 1800 total people. Those 1800 people got to see a really great performance and some timely hitting, like you mentioned.
Absolutely. Before we move on, I do want to give a shout out to Rafael Betancourt, who had the a multi-hit game in this one for the Bulls. He had an RBI and a run, so he's really making a accounting for two of those 3 runs. Doing just enough to get the win. Well, we will move on to Saturday. Saturday, the win will go to Bryce Archie in an 8-6 victory. That makes him 3-1 on the season. Landon Yorick will pick up his third save. Archie did not start the game again. Coach Hanna's going to this, what I would call the extended opener. in which we kind of send somebody out there to hopefully get through the batting order once within, 3 innings, and then we send a bulk guy, quote unquote, out there. And for Saturday, it's Archie, and we did enough to get it done on Saturday and closed out the series. What'd you think?
Yeah, like you said, we did enough on Saturday to get the win. And I didn't think Bryce had his best stuff overall, but he was able to limit the damage overall, going 4 innings, 3 earned runs. We've seen him pitch a little bit better in the past, but one thing that really stood out to me was Jack Nedrow. He had a really good performance. He pitched 2 scoreless innings, and then Landon York came in and got the save. But overall, really great performance by the bats, and some solid clutch pitching as well.
Absolutely, it was very gritty, but it was like we said, it was one of those games where the offense was going to have to show up, and they showed up in droves there on Saturday. Three bulls with multi hits on the day: Jackson Mayo, Rafael Betancourt again, and then Marcus Brodell, who really kind of set the bar for his, his performance tomorrow. But it's kind of pushing forward. We'll get there when we get there. I do want to give a shout out to Lance Triple, as he hit a home run in this one, a big 3-run bomb that really kind of broke the game open, gave the Bulls the lead there that they never really gave back. What did you think watching this game on Saturday from an offensive perspective?
Yeah, really good to see Lance Triple. That was a really hype moment, like you said. Really important part of the ball game to gain that control and to be able to do that with 2 guys on base as well. Big 3-run home run. Really happy to see that. And Jackson Mayo had a great game too, going 2 for 4 with a couple of RBIs as well.
Absolutely. Well, like we said, the offense was really hot on Saturday. They kept it going on Sunday. Pitching stepped up as well. It was a 10-3 victory. Really, from about the fifth inning on, it was, I mean, you could really say from about the fourth inning on, it wasn't really ever in doubt. Once again, Coach Hannes goes with the kind of extended opener, as we start off with Aiden Longoria before giving way to Matt Goldenbaum, and then finally Jorge DeCardenas will finish it off kind of as the bulk guy at the end, pitching the 5 innings but getting the save. It's kind of weird when you look at those box scores. What were your thoughts about Sunday from a pitching perspective?
Yeah, obviously Aiden, he came out, he struggled a little bit, but one thing I was really glad to see is that Coach Hannes isn't allowing his team to get into too deep of a hole before making a change. And Matt Goldenbaum really stepped up. And honestly, I'm surprised that, we redshirted him last year because he not only looked good on paper, but he was throwing 94, 95 miles per hour with control. Obviously, he didn't get any strikeouts, but 3 scoreless innings, only gave up 1 hit, no walks. He was pitching to contact, but his overall stuff is really good. And also, he has a really great mound presence as well. I think he's actually had a string of some good starts or some good appearances as well. So I would definitely like to see his usage continue to go up and, potentially even be that opener to start the game. But aside from that, Jorge DeCardenas, I think, he had pitched his first 4 innings of the outing without giving up a run. Basically, after the game had gotten out of hand, he gave up a run, but overall, 5 innings pitched. Another really good outing, only giving up 3 hits and 2 walks. Really excited to see, what he's brought to the table for the Bulls this season.
Yeah, I mean, hats off to Aiden. He went out there in a kind of a new role. It's a different role than maybe he's used to. Sometimes it goes like you wanted to, and sometimes it leaves with a little improvement. But I do think kind of the strategy with all of this is that, we know Corey Brown's going to get Friday night. We know that Bryce Archie is going to try to pitch 4+ innings on Saturday, and we know that Jorge DeCardenas is going to go 4+ innings, as much as they can, the bulk guys, quote unquote, on Sunday. I think Brandon Keister is maybe locked into that Saturday guy right now. I don't know. We've seen Coach Hannes make adjustments there, so based on his outing, we may see a new guy next Saturday, and we may see a new guy on Sunday. I think these opener roles are kind of up for grabs right now. It has worked three straight times for Keister on Saturday, and so we've seen Coach Hannes kind of be loyal to things and allow them to work themselves out as long as the boat is rocking, the way you want it to. So I'm not really sure what's going to happen there. I like I said, I think Golden Bomb had a great performance on Sunday, or like you said, so he may have earned a shot to get that role. I think the idea is for that first guy to, like you said, get through three innings and then give it off to either Archie or to Cardenas to go as five, six, seven innings that we've seen them do. When that doesn't happen, when they don't get it three innings, we kind of get off script, and it was a big job by Matt there to get us back on script. But the second part to this story really is the offense. We talked about no extra base hits on Friday. Well, we kind of made up for that here on Sunday as Pruitt hits a double. Brodil gets two doubles, and one of those doubles very, very close to getting out of here. It was an absolute missile to the backside. Carlos Hakame hits a double, also adds a home run in this one. Absolute onslaught there on Sunday. What did you think offensively?
Yeah, I think like you said, we really picked it up in terms of our power numbers on Sunday, adding those extra base hits. Marcus Brodil and Carlos Hakame really shined bright on that Sunday game, both going 3 for 3 on base all four times that they were up to the plate. And with that too, they drove in those four runs. And man, I'll tell you what, seeing that home run from Carlos Hakame in person, that was absolutely tanked. It always amazes me to see home runs in person and see the strength that it takes to get around the ball and launch it. But he absolutely destroyed it, and it was another really crucial part of the game to keep adding insurance runs. But overall, really good to see the bottom of the order really producing a lot. Bradkey Laurie added in a base hit as a Lance triple. And then also good to see Ryan Pruitt get an extra base hit with that RBI as well.
Yeah, it was a great, it was a big time offensive Sunday. It's what you kind of hope to see on Sundays, is kind of, pitching staffs and bullpens you hope are as depleted as they're going to be, and so you really want to take advantage of that. And I think that's what the Bulls did in this one. Well, before we kind of move on to look at the ACC, there is one thing I do want to point out. Marcus Brodil was 3 for 3 in this one, had four RBIs. That all worked to get him the AAC Player of the Week honors. So that was a huge, huge accomplishment for him. He had a huge series, again in a big series. We did sweep these awards as Corey Braun also won Pitcher of the Week for the conference. Again, we talked about his performance. Just touch on what you thought about Marcus and Corey.
Yeah, I mean, I think they really showed why, they're not only some of the best players in the conference, but also guys that when July comes around, you're really gonna have to look at, the overall draft and see where they end up going in the MLB draft. I know we had Coach Hannes on, and he, praised both Corey Braun and Marcus Brodil, about their talents, and we got to see that on full display on the weekend and on Friday for Corey.
Yeah, I think, they're both just leaders on this team, and I think it's really great when you see guys that are leading the team kind of get the recognition on the conference level. Marcus has really hit the ball well. I mean, that double that he hit to the backside was an absolute shot. That wall is a couple feet shorter and it's out of here. But it was an absolute tank. And again, we've talked about Corey Brown so much, but we've said everything that there is to really say about him. But at the end of the day, he's just an ace. He's a Friday night guy, however you want to put that. To be fair, we haven't had that guy in the last couple of years. We haven't had a guy like Corey Brown that you could just give the ball to on Friday and say, "Hey, man, put us in a position to win this game," in the last 9 outs. And that's what I think he's given us at the end of the day. He's put us in, given us a chance and put us in a position to win. And again, what he did for us on Friday night put us in a position to do what we did on Saturday, Sunday, because he just took the ball and said, "Hey, I got this, guys. Y'all go win the next two. I'm gonna take this one." And that's an
Yeah,
amazing feeling.
the fact that he was able to save the bullpen like he did, and not only that, but just really happy for him and the team to be able to go out and win a game on Friday, because I feel like the past couple of weeks we've really faced some tough pitching on Fridays and dropped some closer games, and for us to finally get that Friday, and especially with the momentum that we've had on Saturdays and Sundays, I really think it was a key part of the weekend. Just overall putting Friday, Saturday, and Sunday all together as a scripted plan, and it all going to plan, and getting the results that we're looking for.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of the AAC, as we look at the AAC from the last couple of weeks, last weekend was a big weekend. Going into it, you had four of the top five teams playing each other. At the time would have been us and Tulane, UTSA, and Florida Atlantic. When you look at the standings now, you're going to see the top team is East Carolina. They've got two sweeps in conference, but then you're going to see UTSA and South Florida, two teams that passed the test, followed up by Charlotte, Wichita State, which I've been talking about. I think they're better than what their initial conference, or I'm sorry, out of conference schedule indicated. We've seen them kind of jump some teams that had some better OOC years. But followed up by Florida Atlantic, Tulane, UAB, Rice, and Memphis. What are your thoughts here after the first couple of weeks?
I think the number one thing that stands out to me is the fact that going into this conference season, I really thought that both Tulane and UAB were going to be teams that were going to be top of the bracket, or top of the standings rather. And we faced both of them, and we did extremely well against them. And with that, I think we've put ourselves in a really great position. I think when you look at the top of the standings, you look at ECU going 6-0. They've had the luxury of playing Rice and Memphis to start out the year, who have struggled to say the least. Memphis being 0-6 and Rice being 1-5. So I think the jury's still out on ECU, how good they actually are. I know they had a few struggles here and there in non-conference play. So definitely interested to see how they'll continue to play. One thing that I really think is impressive though is UTSA being 5-1 also. They've played a pretty tough schedule to date, especially on the not on the conference side of things, playing against a good FAU team and sweeping that series. So I really think those top three teams, they're starting to really get ahead and really cement themselves in the top of the standings. Obviously, a lot of games still to go. But overall, those are the three teams that you would expect going into the season that would be at the top.
I really, when I look at the top three teams, I'm not surprised. I think those are kind of the three teams I expected to be up there. I maybe, looking at the out of conference year, I maybe didn't expect East Carolina to be 6-0, but like you said, when you look at their first two opponents, it's a little understandable. I do think Rice is going to be a trap team for some teams going forward. The longer that the new coach there kind of keeps building his momentum. It's kind of a weird start time for him to kind of do anything, but I think there's going to be an effect there. I think they're going to win a series they're not supposed to. So I think everybody kind of needs to keep that one circled and make sure you're not overlooking that. Make sure you do what you got to do to get that one, get that win. Another thing that's really struck me in the conference so far has really been the pitching. You look at Norby at East Carolina, Gillespie from Charlotte. We've talked about what Braun's done for us. UTSA has a guy that they pitch on Saturday. His first name's Braylon. I cannot remember his last name, but he's got a really live fastball. But the pitching in this conference has been really, really good. You better bring it on Friday, and you might have to bring it on Saturday as well. But you mentioned the Florida Atlantic pitcher to us earlier.
Yeah,
What are you thinking so far?
his name's Trey Beard. He actually leads the country in strikeouts. The guy's a strikeout machine. I will say I do think his overall strength of schedule prior to playing UTSA was on the weaker side. So he didn't necessarily have a great outing against UTSA this past Friday, but he's obviously shown that he has a lot of talent as well. So, like you said, we got a lot of really talented arms. Fridays in this conference are going to be difficult, no matter who you're up against. But overall, I think the thing that's interesting, especially when you're looking at the first six game stats, cumulative stats of the conference play, USF is faring well in both hitting and on the pitching side of things. I believe currently we're in the top two in terms of ERA, looking at, in the top two or three in batting average as well. Overall, we're playing a really well put together both sides of the ball, baseball right now.
Yeah, we are playing really, really good baseball. I think, really, I think when you look at those top three teams, I think statistically, in terms of wins and losses, East Carolina is probably the best team in the conference. I think when you look at full picture numbers wise, you look at UTSA's overall schedule or record at 23-7. They've probably been the best team overall so far in the conference. But I think we're the hottest team in the conference. In these first 2 weeks in the conference play, we've been, like you said, we've been really hot, pitching really well as a team, hitting really well as a team over 300. I believe the only team in the conference hitting over 300. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, we're actually batting 317 on the conference season so far. And
That's great.
just to add to that as well, in terms of ERA, our team ERA is 3.06, which is actually second to only ECU right now, who's at 2.17 ERA.
Yeah, so I mean, you look at that batting average of the team batting over 300. That's pretty good. Well, not only have we been getting love in the conference, do you have any final thoughts on the conference before you look at these rankings?
Yeah, just one last thing too is just overall the not only are we getting hits and a high average, but our overall team OPS is pretty close to 900 as a team for conference play too. So let's look to keep that going going into the next few series.
Absolutely going to keep those hot bats hot. Looking at the mid-major power rankings brought to you by the 11.7 podcast. Again, we do encourage you to check those guys out. They do really, I believe, the best coverage in mid-major programs out there. UC Irvine Anteaters sitting at 20-5 still sit at top. Really, their top teams haven't really changed. Southern Miss, Troy, Dallas Baptist, Coastal Carolina. Western Kentucky, I think, might be a surprise up there. They're 25-3. Hawaii is still sitting up there at 7. ET East Tennessee State, another team that maybe you haven't heard of, up there in 8. Florida Atlantic sits at 14. East Carolina, sorry, missed them. They sit at 9. UTSA. I don't know how I missed them. I don't, but USF is sitting at 17. What are your thoughts looking at this?
Yeah, I think my overall thoughts is, I might be a little bit biased, but I feel like USF should be a little bit higher than this, higher than 17. Going into this past week, Tulane was at number nine, and obviously we got the big sweep. But overall, I think a couple of things that are interesting in terms of upcoming matches or upcoming games. We actually have number four and number six going against each other this upcoming weekend. In Western Kentucky versus Dallas Baptist. So that's a really big matchup in terms of, the mid-major power rankings. So excited to see how that series ends up going. But the Bulls just got to keep winning. We have games against, UTSA, who's number 12. We have games against Florida Atlantic still, as well as ECU. So all the teams that are currently listed ahead of us in this ranking, we have games against, so we have an opportunity to prove ourselves as the season continues.
Yeah, I think it is going to be a pretty big week. In terms of things, you already mentioned the Western Kentucky and Dallas Baptist thing. It's actually a big week for Western Kentucky. Not only are they going to have that Dallas Baptist series coming up, but they got to play, I believe, Vanderbilt in the week in the midweek leading up to it. So, not a great lead up, into playing a team like Dallas Baptist. But if you want to prove you're the best, it is a great week for it. Mentioning UC Irvine sitting at number one, they actually swept the number 16 team on this list, the UC Santa Barbara Gauchos. They do. The Gauchos do get a lot of love from those guys. So, I mean, I don't know if, maybe South Florida should have been bumped above them or not. But I do believe, you mentioned, South Florida moving up. I don't know how you put Florida Atlantic over us after, what happened with them and after what we kind of did against Tulane. I think somehow, some way, you got to get us above them. I mean, I could see us in that 14th spot. And kind of bumping everybody down from one. We got a good week, a couple of good series coming up to really get that overall record looking good. I think that might be what's kind of dropping us down right now. When you look at some of these, those overall records, as you move up, they tend to be higher than what we have.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. And when you look at it, we're the lowest ranked team with 9 losses as well, which I think is kind of interesting. But like you said, we got some series that we could start building our record up and get a little bit higher in this overall ranking.
Absolutely. And even when you look at it, every team above us has more wins. Like we it's like that win number really means a lot to them. But
Yeah, it's
like you
funny.
said,
It's funny. We've only played 25 games, and you look at some of these teams, they've already played 29 games, like Troy. So we got some games to make up, a lot of baseball ahead of us.
I mean, UTSA's played 30, 23 and 7. I mean, goodness. So speaking of kind of the future, we do want to kind of look at the future outlook for the Bulls. 5-1 in the conference so far. 16-9 overall. 11-7 at home, 5-2 away. Have not played any neutral games. Notable teams kind of coming up. We have Rice and Memphis coming up next. I believe kind of our biggest conference series is going to be towards the end when you have ECU, Florida Atlantic, and UTSA. I think that's, again, that's two of the two teams that are above us there in the last three. We have some big midweeks with Florida, Stetson, Florida State as well. What are your thoughts on the future?
Yeah, I'm looking particularly at the next 8 games. We got, the teams that are the lowest in the standings in the AAC in terms of our next 2 weekend series in Rice and Memphis. Obviously, we don't want to overlook them. We do play them on the road. But, you're looking at Bethune-Cookman, Stetson. I would say Stetson's probably on paper the most challenging team that we have in the next 8 games leading up to that big road game against Florida State. So I think it would be really cool to, continue to build up our winning streak and compile a lot of wins going into that big Florida State matchup. That could definitely have some implications, especially when it comes to our RPI ranking going into, decision time when it comes to the field of 64. I think one thing else too that I think is really important about that is, the next string of 8 games or so, we're playing teams that only one team out of those 8 games is going to be against a team in the top 100. So definitely, that's going to be a really big one to hopefully win at Florida State. That would be huge.
Yeah, you mentioned it. The Florida State game, I think, is probably the biggest game we got kind of on the near horizon in terms of the RPI and everything. And we do have a decent slate before it to maybe try to get right and get hot and stay hot. We played them pretty well in the midweek before. I think they're a little more vulnerable now than maybe they were then. And so you kind of you don't want to read the tea leaves too much on it, but you think, we really got a chance to maybe take that game as we, if we can really get our bats hot. Midweeks can really go crazy, depending on how things happen for anybody. Anybody in the country that it's like that. You do know that they have a really good lineup, and that's going to be really, really tough. Florida's on the schedule as well. They're not looking as hot right now, but when I look at Florida, and we'll talk more about maybe this next week, but I will just mention that there's a lot of talent on that Florida roster. There's a lot of talent that is hurt right now on that Florida roster. I am not too positive on the outlook of those injuries. I don't know how many of them are season ending. I don't know how many of them, are going to return. What I do know is by the time May comes around, May 6th when we have that. They could be a team that is either gotten healthy or the people who are replacing have now gotten up to speed because their backups are good. Everyone that goes to Florida is a good baseball player. And I'm not just saying that's about Florida. I mean LSU, Texas, Texas A&M, which they're not looking great right now either, but Georgia, Tennessee, those guys are good. Even the backups, they're good. And so that's going to be a game that I think is going to be tough. And you just think, you just hope that they turn it around before, because you don't want it to be a situation where not only are they a quad one team, but they're counting as a quad two, because they just haven't built their RPI back up. They're still really, really good. And then again, those, that those last, two out of those last three series, I don't know if we can get to where we want to go if we don't win two of those. So yeah. You have any
And
final
just
thoughts on
to,
the future?
yeah, just to add in on that too, with the quality of talent in the SEC, we see that firsthand. With Brad Keelori, didn't get much playing time at Tennessee last year, but if you guys saw this weekend, not only can he hit, but also that play he made on Sunday was absolutely insane, ranging really, really far to his left and making that stop and getting up. All in one motion and getting the out at first. My brother and I, we were in disbelief when we saw that play in person.
Yeah, it was, he really can flash the leather, really, really well. I think I've said it in a podcast couple weeks ago that I felt like he was a defensive player of the year candidate. I still feel that way. I think he's the best shortstop in the conference. I'll say it. I'm ready to put him in there at the sixth spot all day, and ride with it. I don't know that there's anybody else I'm really wanting to go there, but. He did kind of break out some hitting, here in these last couple of series. I hope he kind of stays hot. We really like I've said in a future cut podcast, or I think it was when we went live, we really need those right-handed hitters to kind of step up when those lefties are on the plate. And he's kind of one of them because you're going to have to put him at shortstop. There's no other reason not to,
Definitely.
All right. Well, I do want to move on now to a national topic. Bear with me for a little bit because we're gonna pop off of baseball, but I promise I'm gonna tie it all back in. But Matt, we saw a tweet. I think I posted in our group chat, but the essential breakdown of the tweet was it looked at the Sweet 16 of basketball, and it listed the logos of the starting five players, but it listed the logos of the schools that they started at. And the only way I can describe this is it was a smorgasbord of other Power Five schools. I think there was one school, props to Purdue, that it was all their logo. They were all five of their starters started their careers at Purdue. And there was one other, I think, when you look at Kentucky and Duke, a lot of those guys are those really good freshmen. So there's three or four. But I mean, some of these schools, in particular, one of the number ones, Florida, had five different logos. I don't think any of them were Florida, and I think at least two of them, maybe three, were small school or mid-major schools. And the implication of this graphic was that transfer portal and NIL has quote unquote killed the Cinderella story. And when you look at the Final Four, it is all number ones. It is the top four teams playing in it. Before I get into my thoughts on it, Matt, what are your thoughts just based on that information?
Definitely a very in-depth topic that has implications across the board when it comes to, whether it comes to, these universities potentially cutting different programs to reallocate funds. Also, we got Division I universities that are now reclassifying to Division III. I believe St. Francis just decided, even though they made the NCAA tournament this year, that they're going to declassify to the Division III level. And then on top of that, you got coaches such as, which is actually kind of interesting. You got coaches like Maryland's coach, who, as a basketball school, you don't really necessarily get that much resources compared to football. So I think a lot of these P4 schools are starting to realize that, at least the coaches are, that they're not going to necessarily have the NIL to compete with some of these bigger, well-known mid-major programs such as like the Big East schools. Because you see, Maryland's coach is actually taking a job at, I believe it's Xavier or Villanova. I always get those two confused, but I think it's just a big mess that still needs to be figured out. But the implications and the ramifications of the whole NIL portal, the whole transfer portal, has really been interesting to follow.
Yeah, it really has been. I mean, just to kind of give some more background on it, the reason being that it's killing the Cinderella story is that these guys are leaving small, players are leaving small schools because immediately after 1 year, and they're taking and going to these bigger schools. Whereas used to, your Cinderella stories weren't teams with freshmen. They were teams with four seniors that, or two seniors and three juniors that had kind of stayed together and built a chemistry together and kind of became like a really good team. And that's kind of what allowed them to be competitive against these teams that had two or three one and dones, and that's kind of how that worked. But with these NIL and really the freedom of the transfer portal, the NIL aspect is kind of how they can really just poach at will. Because like, if you're a kid, how do you turn down some of the money that they want to offer you when you look at your school and that school's like, that's our whole athletic budget. Like, what do you want us to do, man? It's just really, really, it's really tough. And I think it is something that has happened. And I do want to kind of relate this now to say, is this something that we would see now in baseball? Is the days of Cal State Fullertons, of Rice, of Indiana State, to make it hit a little more closer to home with Coach Hannes, are those days numbered? Does the American Athletic Conference need to do everything in its power to become a quote unquote P4, or the top teams are going to have to leave it because, again, like, are we there? Are we at a point where the Cinderella story is not going to exist in college baseball? Do you think this translates?
I think just because of how much money goes into football from the NIL side of things, as well as how much money goes into, whatever is left over, a good percentage of that goes to basketball. I don't necessarily think it's going to have as big of an impact on baseball. I think obviously the SEC schools are going to be able to, get a lot of the top talent, as they have been, historically anyways. But I think that baseball for now is generally safe. And, when we've had conversations with Coach Hannes in the past, a lot of the conversations that he's had with our team coming into this season as well didn't revolve around NIL at all. It was more about building relationships and finding the right fit. And I think that, it might eventually make an impact, but I think for now, I think baseball is generally safe. Obviously, we did, lose some really good talent last year to the transfer portal and Eric Snow and Bobby Boser, but there's other reasons for that as well. But I think overall, I think baseball's in a pretty good spot. What do you think, Adam?
I think the sport of college baseball is in a great spot. I think it's growing at a massive rate. I think the TV deals are coming in. I think other programs are going to look at what ESPN is doing with their streaming and want to get in on that. I think it's only going to go up. I think there's a viewership. I think when you look at the College World Series and you watch those games, that stadium is packed. They're going to have to make it bigger. I think college baseball is in a great state. I think mid-major baseball has a problem. And I think it's the same. We did, and I do want, we did lose a lot into the transfer portal. We brought in a lot from the transfer portal as well. I think the problem becomes, you look at it this way: you've got two good pitchers, and you think they're going to come back, but then one doesn't, and now you're scrambling for a Saturday or a Sunday guy. I just think you're gonna have to constantly be trying to refill these pieces, and I think that the best pieces will like we've seen in basketball, will filter to the top where the money is. You look at a school like Alabama. S s 5, 7 years ago, was Alabama a basketball school?
No.
They are now. I don't know that they were. I think they were good at baseball, but I don't know that they were someone that you're maybe looking at Omaha. They are now. They're still a really good football program. It's because this NIL and transfer portal has given them the ability to use their money and the freedom to move to bring in everything. And I think that's going to go across all sports. Unfortunately, I don't follow women's sports as closely as I can, but I think you're probably going to see the same trend where SEC and Big Ten and ACC, it's essentially those three, and Big 12, the P4.
I think the
Those.
one thing, I think the one thing that is going to continue to be extremely important is just the overall talent evaluation that coaching staffs put together. Because, if you look at it at the end of the day, you got well over 300 Division I baseball programs, with 35 guys on each team. Then that doesn't even take into account Division III or, Division II, where we got Jack Nedrow from, and the junior college ranks is extremely big when it comes to baseball as well. So the talent pool, I feel like, is relatively large when it comes to, being able to find guys to put together a baseball team. You might get lucky and find a guy that maybe a lot of other coaching staffs have overlooked. Obviously it's pretty similar in basketball too, but I think there are some advantages in baseball that, some of the smaller mid-major schools could take advantage of.
Yeah, and this kind of leads us to another point. I saw this. It was a recruiting tweet that said something about how Division One coaches are really, they're if you're P4, they're looking at the mid-major programs hard for their recruiting, and then it's just trickling down. And so, and the first thing that came to my mind was like, hold on, are we creating tiers here? You're telling the, basically the point of the tweet was to tell this high school kid, hey, don't look down on JUCO because that's, you're gonna have to go there and then transfer your way up. You're gonna have to, and I'm just like, hold on, we're creating tiers, except parts of those tiers are trying to compete for the same championship, which doesn't work out if you're not the top tier, right?
And
So
then, then if we really want to get into the extended conversation, then this past year there was the Pavia ruling, the quarterback from Vanderbilt, and he basically got an extra year of eligibility because the court ruled that the year that he spent in junior college didn't count towards his eligibility. So that's another wrinkle into.
absolutely. You know what though? That we're going to talk about that, but we're not going to do it right now because I feel like that's a topic in itself. But yeah, we're definitely, you know what? That might be our next week's topic. It's going to, because the populace, I mean, there were two baseball players that got denied trying to essentially use the Pavia ruling. And so I guess we'll have to look at what, anyways, we'll talk about that. Stay tuned next week. Me and Matt will break down the Pavia ruling and how that kind of will affect baseball. But yeah, I don't know, man. I think it's crazy. Something's gonna have to happen because I think what this really is an example of, and this will be my closing point on it, is I think this is just another example of a decision being made that affects every sport, but really we only considered the benefits of one. What do you think?
No, I completely agree. It comes down to money at the end of the day, and the TV deals are always generated from, football revenue and football viewership. And like you said, it has a trickle down effect, and it's an unfortunate situation where, we'll have to look into in the future, creating NIL contracts, multi-year deals. When a freshman signs with a team, they need to have a level of commitment, maybe. Reserve being able to transfer, to a junior or a senior or whatever that might be. But there's definitely going to have to be some level of regulation involved because, as it is currently, there's a lot of smaller major schools or mid-major schools that are struggling, to compete, and they see the writing on the wall, and that's why we're seeing some schools that are lowering their level of competition. It's really sad to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And you really, what I think needs to happen, and it's And this is where I think we're going, is that we're not going to give scholarships anymore. We're going to give 3-year deals. We're going to have 4-year deals. And those deals are going to have buyouts. You know? So if you're Alabama and you want USF's quarterback, but he's a sophomore, that's cool. But there's going to be a buyout in his football deal that you're going to have to pay the University of South Florida. Or, you know, that it sounds crass, you know, and you, again, it's taking it away from they're not necessarily students anymore. But I mean, I think that's where we're going, right? They're employees. That's where we're wanting it to go. Am I wrong?
Makes sense. I mean, that's kind of how it works with coaches. Why not make it work for the athletes as well?
Absolutely. All right. Well, Bulls fans, if you have an opinion on anything we just talked about, throw it in the comments section. We'd love to kind of discuss it more. But for now, we are going to move on. We do have a midweek coming up. It's going to be against Bethune-Cookman. Bethune-Cookman is 14-14 on the year. It is going to be on Wednesday at 6 p.m. In no, it's not. It's going to be at home. That's right. I went to the wrong one again at 6 p.m. But it is going to be at the Red. Like I said, 14-14. They are 7-2 in their conference. Any thoughts when Bethune-Cookman comes to mind?
Yeah, I'll be really interested to see some guys for us pitch this midweek game that we did not get a chance to pitch this past week. We didn't get to see Nolan Bernard pitch. We didn't get to see Matt Brown pitch. We didn't get to see James Hill pitch or Caleb Ponczak, Lex Sanchez, and Evan Kohler. So I'll be really interested to see a lot of those guys getting an opportunity. I think James Hill has had some really good 3-inning outings his past couple of times out. As has Nolan Bernard, he's put together a string of some solid outings. So really, that's the biggest thing I'm looking for is to see those guys to continue to get experience and work themselves into some different situations and see how they produce.
Yeah, it is a good time to see some new arms that they're going to need to get some work in, but I do think it is important that the bats stay hot. We're going to have to stay hot and win this one. I think historically, it should be a win for us. We are 21-9 overall. We are currently on a 9-game win streak, which is the longest win streak in the series. So if you're Bethune-Cookman, maybe you're looking at it like, hey, we're due, but I am not. We're 11-4 at home. I think we're playing well. I think we're going to come away with a victory here. Any final thoughts on Bethune?
No final thoughts on Bethune, but I did just get a question. I had made a post on Twitter earlier, so do want to get to that. And this question comes from Joseph Brennan, that is Nancy Caro's brother. So the question is, weekend rotation for the next few weekends without having Archie available. And Adam, I'll let you take that question first.
Yeah, well, I mean, right off the bat, you got to look at the fact that, we're going to need a new bulk guy, somebody that's going to come in on Saturday, and pitch that 4+, 5+ innings. You have to wonder who's going to fill that role. Does DeCardenas kind of bump up and kind of go into the Saturday, open something up for Saturday? Does Nedro kind of move up and become that guy? Does it become a true bullpen day, where, we send two or three guys out there with the intention of getting 2 to 3 innings, or I'm sorry, 3 to 4 guys out there with, and try to get through 9 innings with that. So yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. I think in a perfect world, he wasn't, Archie wasn't going to be a part of the Saturday or the weekend rotation yet. But again, we needed him to kind of come in and fill that role. And so, yeah, I think it's going to be a question about where we go as far as that bulk on Saturday. What are your thoughts?
One thing I think that's really interesting and something that Jim Lauck brought up is, we weren't originally, like you said, supposed to see Bryce Archie pitching on the weekends, but as the season has gone on, his role has increased significantly. So I don't know if Coach Hannes is trying to work something out with Coach Golish in terms of his overall availability. I'm not sure whether or not he will travel, but I wouldn't completely rule it out, honestly, because we do know he's very talented. Someone said that they saw that there was 11 scouts watching him this past weekend. So I wouldn't necessarily completely rule him out. But in terms of, if we had to make a makeshift rotation, I think you're spot on. Obviously, Corey Brown's locked in on Friday. Jack Nedrow, we've seen him go six innings in a ball game before, so he can definitely be that bulk guy. He didn't have to do that this past weekend, but he's more than capable of doing that. And Jorge DeCárdenas, obviously, he's done some great things for us as well. I think that's the luxury of having, Nedrow, DeCárdenas, Archie, and Braun is all those guys at any given day, they can go out and give you six or seven innings and pitch you into a competitive ball game. But aside from that, I think it was very promising to see Matt Goldenbaum this weekend. As another option that we can continue to stretch out and potentially be a long inning guy.
Another name I just thought of as you were going through your analysis was James Hill, as somebody we've seen make starts and kind of go distance for us. So he's somebody that could kind of return into that in that bulk rotation role. I think another thing you might think about here is, we play on Wednesday. There might be an audition for somebody on Wednesday to maybe try to go three plus, put him on a pitch count, because again, if you're planning on them kind of going three plus innings or four plus innings on Sunday, there might be an audition. I don't know how long it'll be, a couple innings, but you never know what's going to happen. But I do believe the formula will stay the same. I think we're going to see an extended opener of a bulk guy and then somebody that can close it out. It will be very interesting to see. Do you
Agreed.
have any you have any final thoughts here before we close this one out?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it.
All righty. Well, like we did say, the Bulls will be back in action at the Red, 6 p.m. Bethune-Cookman. If you can't make it out to the Red, you can catch that game on ESPN Plus. For Matt and myself, I do want to thank you for listening tonight. If you haven't subscribed and turned your notifications on, please do that now so you don't miss anything. Be on the lookout for Matt, Mark, and John as they will be breaking down, or I'm sorry, previewing the upcoming weekend series, and also breaking down the Bethune-Cookman midweek. Well, Bulls fans, that's all we got for tonight. As always, go Bulls.
Go Bulls.